And welcome to The Medical Take, a podcast from the Royal College of Physicians and Surgeons of Glasgow. I'm Ariane Laws, consultant physician and rheumatologist in the west of Scotland, and today I'm talking about acute kidney injury with...
I'm Ben Ellion. I'm a renal registrar in the west of Scotland, currently working in Crosshouse Hospital in Ayrshire. We'll be talking about acute kidney injury, partly because it's such a common problem. It's a really serious problem that affects a lot of people. Often even up to one in five people admitted to hospital, and something that we should do some simple things about. And we're going to talk a little bit about trying to demystify a few problems that people often face in the front door of the hospital.
Okay, so I think we're going to start with the, we're going to visualize we're in the acute receiving unit, and the phone rings, one of the nurses answers it and says, got the lab on the phone, I've got some blood results for a patient. The phone's handed to you, and it's a set of U's and E's. Urea is 40, creatinine's 500, and you're now going to tell us what's the first thing that you're sort of thinking about in that scenario?
Yeah, so the first thing I'd be thinking about is, where is this person? Need to find them quickly. Need to go and speak to them and see what's going on. The next thing I'm going to ask the biochemist on the phone as well is, what's the potassium, I guess? Because I think with acute kidney injury, it is a life-threatening problem. And the first thing you've got to think about is the person that's got these blood results safe? Have they got anything life-threatening going on? A creatinine and a urea on their own aren't life-threatening. It's definitely a sign of something bad going on, but need to know what the potassium is first, I would say. Would that be your thoughts as well, Ariane, do you think?
Yeah, exactly that. And as you say, a bit of how long have they been in hospital is this them just coming into hospital? Are they in your hospital? Sometimes it does end up being a sort of phone call from somebody who was at clinic and is now at home, and you've got to try and arrange to get in there as well.
Totally.
But yeah, let's say in this scenario that potassium is 6.1.
Yeah, cool. Okay, so that fits the target range of someone that's got sort of a life-threatening hyperkalemia. So immediately think you've got to do quite a lot, which I think is sometimes the difficulty when you've got someone with acute kidney injury. There's a lot of things often you have to do at the same time. But you go and find the patient, and I think the first thing you see is what's going on with them, why are they in hospital, what have they come in with. And I think basics first, if you get the treatment going for hyperkalemia, which we'll talk a little about later, is you do a thorough history and assessment, A to E, and that's really where your starting point is. The history is going to tell you a hell of a lot about what's going on. You know, is this a problem that's been going on for months and months and months? Or, you know, I've had vomiting and diarrhea for days and days, and I just haven't drunk anything. You know, you start to build a picture of what's been going on, what might be the cause and things.
Mm-hmm. Or, and I've continued to take my Ramapril throughout this period of time.
It's amazing how many people have intractable vomiting for weeks, but I mean, the Ramapril still makes it past. It still gets down somehow.
Absolutely. Yeah. And yeah, you sometimes get that feeling, you walk in and actually they say, I've been feeling rubbish for 3 or 4 months now, actually. And they do just look really unwell. Yeah. And you sort of roll down their socks to have a look and see what their ankles are looking like. And they've got a purpuric rash on their ankles, and actually they say they've had really stiff joints for a while as well, and you're starting to think that maybe there's something else behind this, but you're right, it's absolutely about the history, isn't
it? Yeah, totally. And it's difficult because acute kidney injury is so common, but also there's so many things that can cause it. And so you are sort of approaching it in quite a scattergun kind of approach. You're kind of trying to take in lots of different histories, which could be a systemic problem that has specific symptoms like nosebleeds and that kind of stuff. The number of times I ask about nosebleeds in the front door of medicine is quite small, but actually someone with AKI, it's quite important to know. And maybe it's a sign of something systemic going on. I think everyone appreciates it's a tricky subject to approach, but heart history and first examination is absolutely key. And sort of talking further about the assessment of the person, you know, there's a few things that in Glasgow certainly highlighted that you want to note down, and it's been kind of been taken from lots of guidelines about how to approach and what things to tick off first. And we use the renal acronym, which is rule out sepsis, exclude obstruction, note your analysis, assess fluid balance and look at drugs. And whilst it's sometimes difficult to keep these sort of acronyms in mind, it's, I think, a good way of approaching someone with acute kidney injury and making sure that you've made sure that you've noted these kind of points, because they're the really common causes of acute kidney injury and also some of the really helpful things to know to assess them. A really important point when you're kind of assessing acute kidney injury is make sure you don't look at the EGFR. So EGFR is a number that's generated in a kind of steady state, really useful in chronic kidney disease, but not so useful in someone that's got an acute drop in their kidney function. So don't look at the EGFR, just ignore it. Always look at their baseline creatinine, or if you can get it, or look at the trend of the creatinine. It's always what you would look at in acute kidney injury.
Yeah, and I think it's really easy, particularly often these people are coming in on the middle of a night shift, and it's really easy in the day when you've got time to sort of think about
these things.
If you've got that acronym.
Yeah, exactly. These things exclusively happen at 1 o'clock in the morning when you're stressed up to your eyeballs and the biochemist rings this result through, puts the phone down, and you have a terrible time for the next hour. Exactly.
Yeah. Essentially what that's looking at really is try and find out what the cause of your acute kidney injury is. And you may not find out on hour one, day two, but it lets you start trying to classify that into the sort of different causes of acute kidney injury, whether that's sort of pre-renal, where we were talking about the patient who comes in with diarrhea and vomiting and hasn't remembered or hasn't been advised to stop taking their ACE inhibitor while they're unwell. Something intrarenal. Which we sort of got at with the patient who's been unwell for a few months and maybe has more systemic features, so something like a vasculitis, when we might be thinking about sending glomerular nephritis screens and anchors and things. I think we're going to come on and talk about that, or whether this is something post-renal, which is in the sort of exclude obstruction bit of the renal acronym.
Totally.
Isn't it?
And I have to say, that's one of the ones that I do first, is exclude obstruction, if they're kind of medically stable and safe, is because it sorts out so many problems so quickly. It's something I can do. If typically, so an old man comes in and says, I've not passed, I'm struggling to pass urine for weeks and weeks, that you can feel the bladder up to their chest. And then, you know, with hopefully a simple catheter, that should sort of sort all the problems out rather than going through all the complex.
Yeah, so that's part of the clinical examination,
exactly,
I guess.
Yeah.
But if you don't immediately feel a big bladder, and it's not always immediately obvious, particularly depending on the sort of body habits of your patient, do you do a renal ultrasound on everybody that comes in with an acute kidney injury?
So I can do a renal ultrasound. I'm not signed off to do a renal ultrasound, but actually it's something that's really helpful to know. Especially in people that you can't immediately relieve the obstruction. It's a bit of a nuanced thing. So if you can't relieve the obstruction straight away, then actually I'd have a bit of a lower threshold to dialyze someone. So if a female came in and they've got bilateral hydronephrosis, I can see, then, you know, I need to get proper imaging. So formal imaging, maybe a CT, or if someone's very kind, a radiology chum out of hours would very kindly do an ultrasound for me straight away. And then it might be more of an indication to do dialysis straight away out of hours, because actually you're not going to relieve the obstruction, or if they're safe enough to try and get urgent things like nephrostomies and things of that sorted. And so that kind of information is very helpful. If you can't do renal ultrasound, then a bladder scan is great, really useful knowledge, but again, can be difficult. If they've got ascites or something, you might say, oh, they've got loads of urine in the bladder, but they're just not passing urine. A bladder scanner will pick that up. So generally speaking.
And I guess sometimes for me, it's about how severe the acute kidney injury is.
Yeah.
And the availability of us getting renal ultrasound scans, I guess if it's not as bad as the sort of urea of 40 and the creatinine of 500, I might give it 12 hours with fluids to see whether things are starting to turn around. And if it is, and they've not, you know, they've bladder scanned and they're fine and the bloods are starting to get better, then I might not necessarily jump into doing a renal ultrasound scan.
I think, practically speaking, there will be very few places you can get a renal ultrasound scan out of hours. The thing that's helpful overnight is to get the request in and hand it over to the person in the day. Look, this person's got a stage 3 AKI, which is, you know, their creatinine's, as we said, sort of over 500. They need an urgent ultrasound. Can you please sort that out? Because if they've got, it's in the patient's best interest, because if you're starting the day on that sort of leg up, as it were, you can get the renal ultrasound sorted, you can get it sorted before 12 o'clock, and then you can try and sort out getting the obstruction sorted, rather than, you know, waiting for the ward round to happen, waiting for the FO1 to, or whoever to request, they request the renal ultrasound, and then waiting for the report to come back, waiting for it to be chased, and it sort of puts a lot of delays in the patient treatment.
So we talked a bit about the first assessment and causes of acute kidney injuries there. What treatments are we sort of wanting to get started here?
Yeah, I think treatments are tricky because it's always completely dependent on what's going on. We've talked a little about treatment of kind of a obstructive cause. If you're looking at sort of a treatment of fluid balance problems, so someone that's very hypovolemic and they're very dried out, and that's why their kidneys have shut down or not worked as well, then you want to really start assessing fluid balance and treating hypovolemia as one of the key causes. As our kind of renal acronym says, ruling out sepsis and treating sepsis with antibiotics and things is absolutely key. And thinking about sort of hypovolemia as well, that, you know, if you give the fluids and things aren't getting better, the blood pressure's rubbish, the urine output's not rubbish, you know, do they need escalated to a higher care area? Do they need looked after with more invasive monitoring or even sort of more invasive support, like things like inotropes and that kind of stuff? I mean, I think a famous nephrologist who's now retired commonly wrote in the notes that kidneys need blood. And I always think that's quite a nice phrase to keep in your mind. And if they've got a rubbish blood pressure, if the heart rate's going through the roof, you know that the kidneys are not going to get blood. And trying to support that with things like fluids and inotropes and treating reversible causes is what you're looking to do, and looking at the drugs and stopping them and things.
Yeah, but I think I'd also put in that note of caution that we often see people a couple of days down the line who've had 12 litres of fluid poured into them to try and correct this creatinine
tiny.
That really hasn't come down, and they're now like weeping with the fluid and edema. Sorry, we're talking about filling them up to euvolemia and then stopping and then thinking about, actually, is something else going on here? Do we need to do something else, or is this just going to need time?
So someone that's got a kind of hypovolemia problem, or like, you know, the blood's not getting to the kidney, often will have a bit of overlap. Or if it is a primary kidney problem, then you want to fill them up and then stop. That's it. And they often, you sort of never underestimate how much a patient can take in as well, and put, sort of have that as part of the fluid balance as well. But yeah, you want to fill them up and then stop. Give the kidneys a chance to kick in if they're safe. And just that's why you want to monitor things very closely. And making sure that the patient's safe, making sure their potassium's not going through the roof or their acidosis is not getting too bad and things like that.
Yeah, and you mentioned talking about treatments for hyperkalemia.
Definitely.
I guess on a sort of ward level basis, the thing that you're wanting to do for this person with their high creatinine and their potassium of 6.1, what's the first line thing you're going to give them there?
Yeah, I think that's where it becomes tricky, but you want to make the patient safe first. And so the order of things I usually do is make sure the patient's heart rate and blood pressure are okay, they're not sort of imminently going to become really seriously unwell. Whilst someone or myself doing an ECG, and then whilst that's happening at the same time, you want to be giving either calcium chloride preferentially or calcium gluconate. Usually I say even without ECG changes, because some people don't have ECG changes initially and can still be very sick and unwell. And that will protect the heart. It doesn't do anything to the potassium particularly, but it protects the heart from going into an arrhythmia. And that's usually the first things I would do. And then you would start treating the potassium with things like fluids if it's indicated, and things like insulin, dextrose, as per your kind of local protocol, which is insulin and dextrose given together. And always something we don't actually highlight enough is making sure we tell people, either the nurses or whoever, to monitor the blood sugar, because that can be quite a serious side effect of giving insulin dextrose, because people have different sensitivities to insulin dextrose. So make sure that's done as well for a good few hours afterwards. Yeah, and one thing I always try and say to the nurses, and I think it's really important to say, is make sure you monitor the blood sugar after giving insulin dextrose at least for a few hours afterwards, and make sure you tell someone to do it, because it can be a serious side effect of giving insulin dextrose, especially a few rounds of it, is that you can drop someone's blood sugar because people have different sensitivities to the insulin. So it's always worth mentioning.
And how frequently would you monitor it?
Initially, every half an hour at least, at least for 2-3 hours. There's usually actually a protocol. Most health boards will have a protocol for monitoring after giving insulin dextrose. Certainly, the West of Scotland does.
Yeah. And what about other things that I hear about getting used, like salbutamol and sometimes people getting IV bicarbonate and things like that in these scenarios?
So salbutamol is really useful in an emergency situation. So use at least 10 milligrams of salbutamol. Usually have to give 5 and then 5. But usually if it's serious, I give it up to 20. The 5 milligrams on its own doesn't often affect the potassium level. What that does is it drives the potassium into the cells. But then over the next hour or two, it will seep back out essentially into the bloodstream. So it's not really a treatment, same as sort of insulin dextrose. It kind of buys you time. Salbutamol, definitely whack that on and get that going. But again, usually a big dose of it. And also bicarbonate is very useful in someone that's got bad acidosis. But usually you want to be comfortable using it. Definitely don't use high strength bicarbonate unless it's kind of a cardiac arrest scenario. So you use the kind of, in Glasgow, it's a 1.26% bicarbonate if they've got usually a bicarbonate under 18. But you have to be slightly careful about calcium levels and that kind of stuff. And I think if you're unsure at all, ask a senior before giving it. But it is a very useful treatment because if you correct the acidosis, you can help correct the hyperkalemia, especially if they're passing urine and things like that as well. It's a very helpful treatment to give.
Cool. And another thing that we'd sort of, moving on from that sort of section, one thing that we'd talked about briefly was, I mentioned ANCAs and glomerular nephritis screens and things like that. Yeah. And I suspect we send loads and loads and loads of them for people who have had diarrhea and a really identifiable cause for their acute kidney injury. Definitely. How do you pick out the people that need the whole shebang sent and a myeloma screen and everything else, and who just needs the bloods monitored until they get better?
Yeah, I think if there was one answer to that, like two sentences that would give, I think it'd be very easy. But I think everyone always wonders about that, whether to send a GN screen. And I think unless it's a barn door indication, so this is why you kind of highlight the usefulness of a urine dip and getting it in the medical notes. Because if you know that there's blood and or protein in the urine and they've got a bad acute kidney injury, just send the GN screen for sure. And always things to think about that are sometimes missed because they're not part of a kind of GN screen sort of bundle. It's always make sure you send a CK because that's a simple blood test. It doesn't cost very much and it's really helpful to the helpful to note. And things like a myeloma screen, especially if it's, you know, your acute kidney injury is accompanied with high calcium. Always think of a myeloma screen as well. But things like ANCA and anti-GBM, complements, immunoglobulins, and protein deflectophoresis, things like that. Especially if the presence of protein and blood, always just send it. It does take a few days sometimes for the whole results to come back. And so you don't want to be playing catch-up, you know, if you're trying to get the cause, if things haven't gotten better after 24 hours of fluids and supportive treatment. Always sort of think about that. I think if someone's nephrotic as well, so if they've got low albumin, peripheral edema, and the proteinuria in the urine, you just want to send the GN screen as well. I think there's a bit of a grey area outside of that. My general advice, if someone refers to the kind of renal on-call phones, if you can't identify a definite cause, immediately, then I would send it. It's maybe a waste of resources, unfortunately, but it's that kind of thing of, you know, if you send the anchor away, especially where I'm working in Crosshouse at the minute, it takes a few days to come back and you don't want to be waiting. Like, you know, we've had 3 days of support treatment and things haven't got better. Right, let's send the anchor now. You don't want to be playing catch up, really. Yeah. But I'm sure I'll get a bag.
And as with all these things, it's always really easy if they've got a systemic illness and they've got an abnormal chest X-ray, or like you say, they've got upper respiratory tract symptoms and things, and a big sort of vasculitic rash. I mean, it's an absolute no-brainer that you want to be sending the anchor and the anti-GBM and everything else. It is all of the people where it's a bit grey, that it's a bit more difficult to choose.
Yeah, and if you do have your kind of very typical patient presents with sort of vasculitis symptoms and rash, and they've got a bad acute kidney injury, send it immediately. It kind of pushes that curve of the patient management forward, and you can get the treatment in earlier. It's a really key thing to do overnight. If you see it, you think it's vasculitis, send the anchor, send the ANA, and you know, then you get the result back quicker, you get the treatments in quicker, because they're not going to get better without it. So absolutely.
So you mentioned speaking to the renal on-call team there. You obviously, you know, there's no place under the sun where you could speak to the renal on-call team about every person who had a bit of an acute kidney injury, but which of these people do you want to be hearing about? Who should we be phoning a renal physician to discuss?
Yeah, I think there's some definite ones. There's some sort of, I think there's ones where you get a bit of a hint that something's going on overnight and you're just not happy about them. I think there's some definite things you should call. If I was a registrar on call about, and I was kind of managing all the renal patients across Glasgow, sort of from afar, as sometimes is the way it's structured, but I want to know for acute kidney injury wise that if they've got an indication for dialysis. So again, another acronym I would throw out just for sort of ease in remembering for any medical students listening and things like that, AEIOU, so acid base disturbance, so very severe acidosis, so pH under one, under 7.1. Electrolyte disorders like hyperkalemia, which we talked about, that's resistant to treatment. So you've given things like insulin dextrose and it's kind of gone up or gone down and then come up. I need to know about it. Intoxication with sort of poisons, which not really particularly related to acute kidney injury. Overload as well. So if you piled fluid in and they've got load, really breathless, they're not passing urine and they're needing more and more oxygen. Again, it's really important to know about that. And uremia, which is a bit of a soft one, if you were, but if someone's just really not very well, they've not been eating, you know, it's just basically the toxins that's floating around and making them very unwell. They may be encephalopathic or they may have pericarditis and things like that. If you suspect that, just give renal on call or phone. I think if you suspect rapidly progressive glomerulonephritis, so they've got blood and protein in their urine, they've been feeling unwell for a few weeks, and they've got maybe a rash or they've got a little bit of hemoptysis, like blood in the spit, definitely give us a call. And a stage 3 AKI is always worth knowing about. So, you know, there's different ways of kind of characterizing AKI, staging AKI, but generally a stage 3 AKI would be kind of 3 times the baseline of the baseline AKI, of the baseline creatinine, or an increase in serum creatinine to 350-odd. Want to know about it. Again, or if anuric. If someone's got anuria and they've got a bad acute kidney injury, things aren't going to get better. So we need to know about it. Do they need to come across to a place of safety if you need to put them on dialysis? Things like stage 2 AKI or unresponsive to treatment for a few, for a day or two, then it's always worth discussing with it. You know, can we help with the management? Can we advise on the management? And again, it's good for us to know about them. And I think there's other reasons to call renal on call, but that's from the AKI things. I think that's probably the main things I would want to know about. Sometimes hematologists call us as well, or respiratory people, if they think they've got an anchor vasculitis or pulmonary hemorrhage or something like that, then there might be, you know, an indication to come for dialysis, and also things like plasma exchange and things. We often have a hand in that as well, and sometimes look after these patients as well.
Yeah, and obviously any kidney transplant patients coming in with bloods that are out of keeping with what they should be, or unwell with other things, I think we often end up phoning you guys just to check in.
Outside of AKI, it's always worth knowing about an unwell dialysis patient or an unwell transplant patient, because we understand it's like kind of specialist treatment, specialist management, and things get quite complex when you shut down someone's kidneys or you replace it, you know, so... always happy to take a call about those kind of things, for sure.
Yeah, and it's been a wee while now since I've had to be the first person that's making that phone call, and I vaguely remember having like big piles of notes and charts and everything else to try and field all of the questions. what information should somebody who's phoning the renal team have to hand when they're phoning you so that they can look really slick and answer all of your questions like that?
Yeah, I think you sometimes hear people shuffling all the paper they've got in front of them. You feel sorry for them. They've clearly been sort of gathering every single bit of paper about them since, 1990, and they've got it in front of them. But I think things that the basics, if someone's unwell, someone's really sick and they need dialysis, that doesn't take too long. I would again just think about the renal acronym. So, are they septic? Are they obstructed? Or at least, is there any suggestion of obstruction? Urinalysis doesn't take long unless they're obviously not passing any urine. Fluid balance, we need to know what that is. And also the drugs that they're on, the medications they've been taking, and whether they've taken any sort of poisons and things like that. That's kind of the basics, I would say. Sometimes it's, you've got things like, are they catheterized? Are they passing urine? What have you given? As I say, I think make sure that you've started treatment to make them safe. So a few times we've had to sort of say, right, can you ring me back after you've treated them, or at least started the treatment for the high potassium? I think that's really important because sometimes it's, they've got an acute kidney injury, I need to ring renal. But I think the most important thing to say is, you need to make the patient safe and start your treatment, get a bit of assessment done, and then ring renal is usually what I would say.
Yeah, and I think it's about that, really wanting to get help and wanting to make sure you do the right things to sort of get the patient to safety. But unless the renal unit is in your hospital, in the building that you're in, or even if it is, that's going to take a period of time to get that person transferred, and you want them to be safe for transfer beforehand, don't you? So there's lots of simple things that you can do and get underway before they get transferred across. I guess talking about transfer.
Yeah, I think that's what. Yeah, we kind of help with the sort of safety of transfer, but it is tricky, and that's why on the ground, if it's sort of not in the hospital that the renal unit's in or the dialysis is in, the seniors kind of need to know, and often the consultants need to know that this person's potentially need to go across the city or, to another city or whatever it is. And I think making sure that things are as safe as possible. Again, that's tricky to kind of always guarantee that someone's going to be safe to go across, but some things you can do. So, again, talking things like simple things like monitoring the blood sugar, need to make sure that's being done, how much oxygen they're needing, are they going to imminently need things like CPAP or high flow nasal oxygen? Because that's not good to happen to someone in the back of an ambulance. Reverse anticoagulants, if you have the presence of mind to do that, so they can get a safe line when they arrive. Whether they're cardiovascular unstable, and I think that's another important point, is if they're really unwell, if they're really sick and they're just not perfusing their kidneys, there's something else going on. Do we need the intensivists to kind of come down and help out sort of locally, or even there's almost something else going on that they may be too unstable for dialysis in a renal unit and things. And the big one is hyperkalemia. We need to get that down. Generally in Glasgow, we say under 6.5, especially in acute kidney injury. Again, because it's in the best interest, it may seem a bit silly to kind of delay transfer until that happens. But if you get the potassium down safe enough for transfer, then that's going to be much more in the patient's interest than just stick him in the back of an ambulance with a potassium of 8. And that's a potential for bad things to happen, for sure.
And sorry, one thing that I meant to ask earlier when we were talking about potassium treatment, once you've given them their insulin, dextrose, calcium chloride, salbutamol, when do you want the bloods rechecked? How soon?
So usually I would say half an hour and check a venous gas. That's what you usually say to people. So after they completed their treatment of insulin dextrose, I would say after that's finished, give about half an hour and then check the potassium and the venous gas. Reason being, so potassium, serum potassium can go away to the lab, but that often takes 45 minutes to an hour, even an urgent sample. A venous gas will give you a ballpark figure. Are you making any headway in this at all? And that's useful information to know. It'll give you a rough estimate of potassium, but you can't rely on it. So you always kind of say, send them both. But that's a really useful thing to know. And it's usually what I say to people.
Okay. I'm going to ask you a really easy question to answer now. So What about contrast in acute kidney injury? So you've got somebody who's coming breathless, and you maybe want to you're thinking they've got ANCA-associated vasculitis, and they've got some respiratory symptoms, and you want to do a CT. Can I give these people contrast? Is that I hear different things all of the time as to whether or not contrast-induced nephropathy exists or doesn't exist?
Yeah, I thought you said this podcast would be half an hour, Ariane. I think probably could. I think if you really want the full response to that, it'd probably be, I'm afraid, an hour and a half later. But I think how I would summarize it is, it's a bit of a monster, and there's some really good kind of discussions around it and sort of meta-analysis kind of looking at it. I think what I would say is, if the scan's essential and it's going to change their management, usually what we say is give the contrast. You know, if you're looking for an abscess, you're not going to see with contrast. If you're looking for ischemic gut, for example, is a big one that you're not going to see with contrast. You need to do the full scan to sort of inform the patient's management. There's some things you can do if the scan can be delayed for a while to try and stabilize the patient. So generally advise sort of withholding medications that can affect the kidney, for example, for ramipril and things like that. Sort of altering their fluid status, so making sure they're nice and hydrated, making sure their blood pressure is okay, making sure they've not got infection as much as possible. There's a caveat to that. If they've got a kidney transplant, I would always give us a shout before giving contrast, just in case it can affect their kidney. It's probably a factor that's kind of overplayed now, but it's very difficult to say that because sick people get contrast scans, and so it's really difficult to pick it apart. That's usually my advice, is if you need to do it, then do it. But if you have a bit of time to stabilize the situation, then usually go for that. As we talked about, assess them and treat them as best as possible.
And if you had to give us your sort of kidney top tips for acute kidney injury, what would be your top tips?
Top tips would definitely be, it's a bad thing. People that have a stage 3 AKI have at least 33% in hospital mortality, so one in three of the people you see will die. The initial assessment history and ATE is key. Urine output is absolutely, knowing how much they're passing you is really key. Your analysis is so helpful when you're trying to tease out the cause and get it in the notes. So we sort of got it there. Managing the patient, making sure they're safe. Creatinine of 500 is scary, but the potassium of 7 or 8 is scarier. And I think, if in doubt and you've kind of had gone through it with your senior or whoever, do just refer to renal and give us a call. We're always here for friendly advice, sometimes stressed advice, but generally, we're always here to help, really.
So are there any sort of useful resources or pointers or things that you think people should read to learn a bit more about acute kidney injury and the management?
There's loads of things out there, really great things, and it's a monster topic, so it's worth reading about. So BMJ Breast Practice is really good. Section on this, up to date if you can get access to it. The Renal Association and NICE both have guidelines that are really, really helpful to read and very practical advice. And also local guidelines, often there's sort of acute kidney injury guidelines locally. And on Twitter and things like that, there's NEFJC, which is always worth reading and gives you really good detailed, sort of balanced information, I think.
Saving the kidneys of the west of Scotland. Yeah. So thank you, Ben, for joining us today for this episode. We hope that our audience all found that useful. Please ask any questions or give comments and suggestions, any feedback welcome, using the hashtag #TheMedicalTake. And please follow the college on Twitter at @RCPSGlasgow. Bye.
Bye.